American Heritage.
Ours is the heritage of Western civilization. A civilization built by adventuring men through 30 generations of trial and glory, from the Middle Ages to the 20th century.
Today, Heritage dramatizes the exciting story of a means of communication that links the world. The Mails, with Charles Irving as narrator.
The time, 500 years ago. The place, a dusty, narrow country road in France that winds and twists among the farmers' fields. The sun is hot, the air humid, the scene quiet and lazy. On the road, an old man and his son plod along, leading a bony horse, pulling a small cart.
Another hour, my son, and we shall be at the village.
Then 2 whole hours to walk back home.
Why complain, my son? What is there to be in a hurry about?
But a mile behind them, someone is in a hurry. A horseman, bent low on the saddle, gallops with fury down the road. His horse charges around the bend. The farmer tries to move the dusty cart out of his way. The horseman flies past them, cursing them as he swerves his horse to avoid a collision.
What a villain! Does he think he owns the roads of France? Who can he be?
The racing horseman covers league upon league with but brief rests and quick swallows of food and water for animal and rider. Then, silhouetted against the setting sun, the forbidding towers of a castle come into view. In the gathering dusk, flickering torchlight here and there illuminates the tall, narrow windows. Armored sentries pace the walls.
Guard! Guard! Down with the bridge! I am awaited!
In a moment, the bridge is lowered into place. The iron-studded door in the gateway rises cautiously. At the first possible second, the rider thunders across the drawbridge and into the inner court. The gate grinds shut behind him. Torches blaze. Men in clanking armor crowd around the rider.
Make way, you fools. I dare and lose a moment.
Clear the way. He is awaited by the king.
The dusty cloaked rider dismounts and strides purposefully through door after door. The exhausted rider approaches and kneels before the small, weazened man at the head of the oaken council table.
Your Majesty, I have the honor to bring you letters from the encampment of your devoted army.
The king's own messenger has completed his mission. He has delivered the royal mail.
The entire journey, Your Majesty, was accomplished in 3 days of riding.
What? Give me the letters.
Here, Your Majesty.
You shall be rewarded well with the post of chief of the king's messengers.
Louis XI, in the medieval year of 1464, had inaugurated a courier service, a foundation of the French postal system, and a model for many others to come. Crafty King Louis had a reason for what he did.
We must unify what we call France, my friends. And to defeat those who oppose us, we must always be able to act more promptly. That means we must have all available information first. Therefore, I am inaugurating a courier service. We shall have 250 of our finest young men as couriers. They shall have the best horses, with fresh horses awaiting them at selected points along their way. And we shall carefully map out the routes for them to follow to the remotest edges of our land.
Your Majesty, we all humbly pay tribute to your Majesty's genius.
Oh, don't be a fool. The same thing was done in ancient Persia, and it helped them build a great empire. Don't you think we can do the same, eh?
Thus, crafty Louis sought to break the isolation of men from each other, an isolation resulting largely from the few and bad roads of medieval Europe. For it was fundamentally the lack of communication that kept Europe in a state of cultural backwardness. Imitating the King of France, cities and merchant groups seeking trade with others and universities also created messenger networks. Yet they were limited in the letters they might carry. Couriers went on official business only. The ordinary man had no organized way of sending letters.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, I have come here to this tavern to seek one who perchance travels to Rome. One who might deliver a letter to the brother I have not seen for years.
And weeks, months, even years later, that letter might be delivered, handed from one traveler to another, or more likely, never delivered. Then, on March 1st, 1500, a significant event took place at the court of Philip I, King of Castile, Leon and Granada, Archduke of Austria and Duke of Burgundy, Lorraine and Brabant. In short, the ruler of the Netherlands and its dominions.
Francis von Taxis.
Your servant, Your Majesty.
In recognition of the services of your father, Roger von Taxis, as master of posts to the late Emperor Maximilian I, in honor of your own services in our dominions as a master of couriers, now, therefore, it is the royal pleasure to appoint you captain and master of our posts.
The appointment of Francis von Taxis as captain of Philip's postal service was the latest of many appointments given to members of the Turm and Taxis family as post and courier experts for a dozen European countries. But with the appointment of Francis of Turm and Taxis, what had formerly been a hit-or-miss irregular service was to be transformed for the first time into an organized, regularly planned, and scheduled operation.
My court undertakes, von Taxis, to pay you 12,000 livres per annum to continue and enlarge your courier services.
Permit me, Your Majesty, to tell you my plans. On this map, we undertake to maintain mounted courier service according to a rigid schedule. From Brussels to Innsbruck in Austria, 5.5 days in summer, 6.5 in winter. Between Brussels and Paris, a mere 44 hours. From Brussels to Lyon, 4 days. To Toledo in Spain, 12. And to Granada, 15.
But the new organization soon ran into financial trouble. And in an effort to solve that problem, a second great step forward in mail service was made, which was for the first time to benefit people without privilege.
The royal expenses are great, von Taxis. We simply cannot continue to pay you 12,000 livres a year.
Does Your Majesty find fault with my service?
No. It is simply a matter of the money.
Then Your Majesty would not object if I were to find money elsewhere?
Elsewhere?
Permit my couriers to carry the letters of private persons.
The letters of private persons to be carried by royal messengers? A dangerous plan, von Taxis.
By charging fees, we can reimburse ourselves, and Your Majesty need pay only for what the treasury can afford.
But promise me, von Taxis, that at no time will the letters of private persons be allowed to interfere with the speed of royal dispatches.
Let that be written into a new contract.
Meanwhile, in England in 1637, the royal postmaster Witherings, seeking to stimulate public use of the royal post, set up the first system of postage in the British Isles based on the main post roads with branch lines.
Hey, see there, Jim. Under 80 mile, a letter costs you tuppence.
Up to 140 mile, fourpence. Above 140, sixpence. Yeah, mighty high.
And to Scotland, Jim, eightpence. Far too much for a poor man.
What's more, in all our great city of London, only one place to post a letter.
As local and cross-country services improved and the roads improved, postal couriers afoot and on horse were gradually replaced by mail coaches built for speed and endurance, covering hundreds of miles according to rigid schedules. Speed became their mania.
Coachman! I say, coachman, have you no regard for our limbs and lives?
All of your limbs and lives to me! I'm the iron car!
Even in London, the speed of the mail coaches became a menace, as reported in a passage from Charles Dickens' novel, Little Dorrit.
They ought to be prosecuted and fined, them mails. They come a-racing out of Lad Lane and Wood Street at 12 or 14 miles an hour, them mails do. Why, a native Englishman is put to it every night of his life to save his life from them mails.
Yet it was precisely the dizzying speed of the mail coaches that ushered communication. The new concept of punctuality to the minute moved the mails faster than ever before, and the nightly departure of 28 coaches from the London post office became a famous sight. The English author De Quincey wrote of the spectacle,
"Every moment are shouted aloud by post office servants the great ancestral names of cities known to history through a thousand years, expressing the grandeur of the empire by the antiquity of its towns, and the grandeur of the mail establishment. You hear the thunder of lids locked down upon the mail bags. Then come the horses into play. What stir, what sea-like current, what a trampling of hooves, what a thunder of wheels.
But at the same time, in the busy commercial city of Liverpool...
See there, Mr. Sherman. Mailbags on a steam train. What do you think of that?
Ridiculous. My horse coaches are the fastest thing in England. These absurd trains can go barely 12 miles an hour at best. Why, they'll never put us out of business.
But by 1844...
Remember this spot only a few years ago? 28 mail coaches leaving London every night. Thousands of people came to watch and cheer. But now...
Aye, it is a little sad. But the mails do move faster now.
Speed, regularity, lower cost. These three goals took the mails out of their ancient function as a privilege limited to special groups, and made them serve the growth of our heritage within the narrow borders of Europe. But what of the newer continent far to the west? A continent bigger than all Western Europe, but comparatively a wilderness. Here, the problem of postal service was complicated by greater distances and fewer towns. Nothing better dramatizes the tragic slowness of the early posts in the fledgling United States than the events of early 1815. Toward the close of the War of 1812 with Great Britain. Event number one. In Belgium, a meeting of British and American plenipotentiaries.
Now, your signature, sir.
At once. There. Our two nations, sir, the United States of America and Great Britain, are again at peace.
His Majesty's government are deeply gratified.
We must send a messenger at once to the United States. Hostilities must cease.
The messenger bearing the news of peace sets sail across the Atlantic. Meanwhile, the American government and people are waiting tensely for news of a great British force on its way to attack the Americans at New Orleans. Then, event number two, on January 8th.
General Jackson, we have won the Battle of New Orleans. We have beaten the British and won the war.
It is good news. Order a rider to depart for Washington at once, with letters announcing our victory.
In the absence of news of the treaty already signed in Belgium, in the absence of news of the victory which had already taken place in New Orleans, the eastern states tortured themselves with wild rumors and fears. Then, on February 4th, almost a month after General Andrew Jackson's great victory in New Orleans...
A courier! News from New Orleans!
Take me to the president quickly. We have won the war.
Yes, we had won the war that had already been ended. It was not for another week that the ship from Belgium crept into New York Harbor with news of the treaty. A messenger rode breakneck for Washington. Peace! Another set out at once to tell General Jackson in New Orleans. He rode hard for 19 days.
General Jackson, peace has been agreed. The war is over.
Good. Then it was our victory here in New Orleans that did it.
General, the peace was signed in Belgium 1 week before your victory.
What? Victory. 2,000 men killed and maimed because the news did not come to us in time.
Distance, wilderness, these were not the only obstacles faced by the American mails. There was also the fact that the frontiers were constantly expanding. New frontiers demanding better contact with the old. By the mid-1850s, express companies had sprung up by the hundreds to haul mail, passengers, and freight ever westward. Great names have entered our history this way. The Adams and Wells Fargo Express Companies and hundreds of others. But California was still a long way from the east, and mail went there by boat to Panama, across the isthmus by land, again by boat to San Francisco. Each time the mail boat came in, men stormed the post office.
You got a letter for Hendricks? Robert Hendricks of Boston?
Hendricks. Nope, Hendricks. Nothing for you, sir.
I came around the horn. My family were to commence writing after I've been out here a month. Now it's 8 months and I haven't got a letter.
Another man gets a letter, reads it through smiles and tears, while another turns away in disappointment.
I haven't received a letter from my family in 2 years. I thought it might be the fault of the Mountain Express, so I've come down here from the mountains 300 miles. And I've spent $150 to try to get one letter from home. And I can't get it. I just quit writing. It's no use.
Meanwhile, the railroads had forced their way as far west as St. Joseph, Missouri. But between that spot and San Francisco towered two menacing mountain ranges, the Rockies and the Sierras, which blocked every attempt at straight-line overland delivery of mail to the west coast. The bones of men, women, children, animals dotted the various routes, victims of the elements, of bandits, of hostile Indians. Until three men, Russell, Majors, Waddell, experienced Western freighters, founded an audacious plan.
Gentlemen, there are 500,000 people on the western side of the Rockies. They are as much a part of the USA as we are here in Missouri. I propose a new express company. 80 riders, the finest we can find, to carry mail only. A weekly service in both directions between Missouri and the Pacific, 12 months a year. The Central Overland and Pikes Peak Express.
Its name in history is the Pony Express. April 3rd, 1860, the railroad station of St. Joseph, Missouri. The mail is due in on a train from the east. An excited crowd mills about.
Come on.
bag of mail addressed to San Francisco passes quickly to 23-year-old Johnson William Richardson, the first Pony Express rider.
Good luck, Johnny! It's the Leather Boy!
He mounts his horse and speeds on the first leg of the 2,000-mile trail to the west. After 20 miles, he approaches the first relay station.
Pony Express, coming!
Pony Express!
Fresh horse awaits him. Swiftly, the mailbags are transferred. Richardson remounts.
A minute and 10 seconds, Johnny. Now, good luck.
Come on, boy.
20 miles further along, a relay rider with a fresh horse waits impatiently. The mailbags once again change hands. Richardson has completed his 40-mile run. A new rider takes over, racing westward to hand the mailbags on at other relay stations to new riders on fresh horses. Far to the west, other riders start east. Somewhere on the trail, they pass. The blazing heat of deserts, the freezing cold of mountain passes, all those miles are eaten up by the driving hoofs of the pony riders. 10 days after the mails left St. Louis, San Francisco. 2,000 miles in only 10 days, and the mail reached San Francisco. Week in, week out thereafter, the men and horses of the Pony Express carried the mail at $5 an ounce across 2,000 miles of virtual wilderness. They died by Indian attack. And often the horses ran on alone. Weather, accidents took their toll. But other riders went on through. By the spring of 1861, more hung on the Pony Express than the mail of the public. Secession in the South was splitting the Union. If the inaugural address of the new president, Abraham Lincoln, was strong and firm, California might be held for the Union. Word went out to every Pony Express station.
Clear everything for the president's message!
Rains, floods, quicksands delayed the riders. Their animals lost, they walked to the next station. 3 horses were ridden to death to make up lost time. But the message was delivered. Against 3 to 6 weeks from Washington to the Pacific by ship, the Pony Express helped keep California in the Union by cutting the time to less than 2 weeks. The Pony Express was in existence not much more than a year. Yet it was a year that made the pony the most romantic, exciting episode in American communications. It ended only when the telegraph poles marched across the nation, soon to be followed by the railroads and the airplane, to the full flower of mail transport as we know it today, an international network. This great achievement, the sum of myriad achievements of men known and unknown, is a tribute to man's will to knowledge and mutual understanding. The mails, the means by which we exchange ideas, both great and small, are the sinews of our common strength, the mighty sinews of the heritage of Western man.
American Heritage is a presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.